Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, 51551 is the text. Now, the best summer read of the year is here. Aisling Rawl is a teacher from County Leitrim. She's written The Compound. It is very addictive. It's lighting up the writing world. The New York Times raved about it. Good Morning America on ABC television have added it to their July book club. What is it? Well, it's a dark, savage tale. At times very funny as well. Looking at our relationship with consumerism and influencer culture. It's Love Island meets The Hunger Games in a desert with some empty, sad souls. Aisling Rawl, good morning.
Hi.
You're from Leitrim. Not the first writer to come out of lovely Leitrim. John McGahern, of course, is there as well. There's quite a few people from Leitrim, aren't there, around the place? A motley crew. Paul Williams, the crime journalist. Catherine Lynch.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent. Seamus O'Rourke as well. It's from the same village as me. Yeah, Carrigan.
Where exactly, Carrigan? Where exactly in Leitrim is that?
It's South Leitrim. It's near the Cavan border.
Oh, yeah. But is that near Arva, where the three provinces meet?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
It's a rural upbringing?
Yes, very rural. Not a lot going on, but it's a nice place.
Not a lot going on until now. come here, you did teaching. Where did you study your teaching?
UCD.
UCD. And was this your kind of driving force in life? You wanted to be a teacher?
Yeah, I think I studied English in college and I didn't really know then that I wanted to be a teacher, but I started teaching piano and then I thought I'd kind of marry the two. And I really loved it. It was a great time.
Does that mean now you've kind of stopped teaching?
Yeah, I stopped after Christmas and I definitely miss it a lot. I still kind of annoy my students and want to know how they're getting on and pop up at graduations and things like that. They're probably trying to get rid of me at this point.
And it was secondary?
Yes, yeah.
So you just finished at Christmas. You actually did follow up, didn't you, during exams and so on?
Yes. I kind of can't stay away.
I was just going to say, it sounds like you're a great teacher.
Oh, well, look, I love the kids. I was very lucky to work with such great kids all around.
Is this what happens to the... This is why we have a shortage of teachers. They go become novelists.
Yeah, I guess so.
What did you like to read, by the way, when you were younger?
I liked all sorts, to be honest. I remember Enid Blyton and Judy Moody and kind of pulling books from my mother's bookshelves that I probably shouldn't have been reading just yet. But I think classic Enid Blyton and then later, you know, Harry Potter and all that.
You're a long way from Enid Blyton.
Yeah.
This brings us to, it's a debut novel, The Compound. You wrote this book in the summer of two years ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
In a frenzy.
Yeah, I suppose I had just finished my first year of teaching and I wrote it in about 6 weeks over the summer and it all just felt very cathartic, I think. It was a really fun experience and it kind of felt like a fever dream. But I think that kind of writing it so quickly, maybe I think once it was over, I kind of felt that it had been written by someone else almost. Like going back to it felt quite strange, but it was a really fun time.
Every novelist in the country is cursing you now, going, 6 weeks.
It's sickening, I know.
It is sickening. It's like, I'm kind of worried. Tell us about the novel in your words, because I've been describing it. I don't know if I've been doing it right.
No, it sounds great. I kind of, the pitch is that it's Love Island meets Lord of the Flies. It's sort of a satire of reality television and it kind of gets a little bit dark. But as you were saying, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about kind of consumerism and materialism and kind of the darker underbelly of these shows.
The New York Times say the story takes place inside a demented reality competition program that's basically the musical chairs from hell. 20 people, 10 women, 10 men selected to live in a desert house and the person who lasts the longest at the compound wins and they win all of this glitzy, glamorous stuff, basically all the stuff that we covet and look for. There is kind of reality hinted at here, though, isn't there? There are wars unspecified going on in the background. Is that you kind of saying that the echo of all this reality TV show is we're ignoring the news?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I wanted to look at the idea of escapism in a pretty literal way, and that escapism for the viewer slash reader, but also for the contestants in a very literal sense, and that particularly Lily, the protagonist, is really going there to kind of bury her head in the sand. And I think that that's kind of how it feels at the minute sometimes with entertainment, and particularly what we call, you know, mindless entertainment like reality television, that we really just want to shut off and we don't want to think about the fact that the world is burning.
I know. And you kind of can't blame a lot of people for doing a bit of escapism, but it shouldn't be total.
Yeah. I suppose there's probably a happy medium. I think in this context, they're extremely isolated and shut off, and Lily doesn't really want to think about it at all. But I suppose her relationship with reality is sort of tenuous enough and definitely gets worse in this kind of highly manipulated environment.
And what kind of is the interesting thing about your novel is the fact that we can just enjoy your novel as mindless escapism and ignore all the lovely messages that you've probably thought long and hard about consumerism and that kind of that vacuous need in the human to just get stuff which we think is going to make us happy. But of course, we know it's not going to do anything.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm happy for anyone to, you know, just have a fun time reading it. I hope it's kind of entertaining. But if you wanted to have a conversation about, you know, consumerism or, you know, late stage capitalism, that's fine with me as well.
Okay, forget the late stage capitalism. tell us the fun rules, because you've come up with really, like, really exciting rules in a show that someday this thing is actually going to exist for real.
Yeah, I think one of the rules that I had fun with was that the contestants aren't allowed to reveal any personal information, and therefore without knowledge of age or jobs or background or education, they kind of still naturally seek a hierarchy, I think, and a sort of social structure.
Yeah.
And they kind of therefore are beholden to the rules of the show. So one of the first sort of tasks that they're given is to rank each other according to attractiveness, which is something that you see on these shows a lot, which I just think is so terribly cruel.
Yeah.
But it's a useful hierarchy for them. So almost immediately they can kind of say, she is the most beautiful, she has the power, and so and so.
They're ranking each other. And it's such a clever way to introduce us to so many characters.
Yeah, I suppose there was a lot to kind of handle there. But as well as that, the characters can speculate about each other's personal lives. They just can't reveal it themselves. And the other rule, I suppose, that's important is that they're not allowed to physically harm each other until the final five. So
rules start to disappear.
Yeah, the rules disappear. So it's kind of an illusion of civility until it kind of suits the viewers, I suppose.
But if they let slip about something personal about them or something, there's a penalty, punishment. Some of them are quite severe.
Yeah.
What are the personal tasks?
So the personal tasks are for the individuals, and they offer fairly superficial rewards like makeup or ornaments or sort of pretty baubles. And there's also communal tasks which benefit everyone, and everyone has to participate in order to kind of
but the genius of the personal task is someone is sent by their little screen to do something, no one else knows that you're doing it, to get a bracelet or a fan or a shampoo.
Yeah,
it could be.
Yeah.
So you have this extraordinary manipulation of it, but that's the TV pitch, by the
way. Absolutely, yeah. So I suppose because they're not allowed to reveal their personal tasks, they all kind of have to second guess each other's intentions. So, you know, an instruction might be, you know, to have a conversation with someone or to skinny dip in the pool or to braid someone's hair, and therefore all of their actions sort of don't feel genuine. And
yes,
it's a very sort of kind of frail sense of community that they have, because it's built on the premise of winning things for interacting with each other.
And the communal task, which we're familiar with in Love Island, they're to get things like a front. There's no front door on this compound in the scorching hot desert. The place is in a mess.
Yeah,
when they get there.
Yeah.
And they don't have stuff.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting to me, in that each batch of contestants inherits the house as it was left in the state by the contestants previous to them. And when this batch of contestants arrive, they see that even though the house is quite glamorous, it's also quite dilapidated, as if they had sort of wrecked it very recently.
Yeah.
And I think that this bunch of contestants, as is the sort of feeling with each generation, is I can't believe they left the place like this. We would never do that. We're going to leave it so much better. Yes. But alas, the best laid plans.
We haven't spoiled anything, by the way, even yeah. though it sounds like it. The line that sums up best in the New York Times review is, it's entertaining to watch hot people do psychotic things. Yeah. You could nearly make that the strap line of this book, isn't it?
Yeah.
How did you feel writing this? Did you kind of know, did you map out who was going to be knocked out? Because it is like watching the TV show and we get to like a character and we're wondering the following night, are they going to be evicted or what's going to happen?
No, not at all. I really never knew what was going to happen next, which was, I think, partly why I wrote it so quickly. I was so eager to know sort of who was going to stay and who was going to go. So I really felt like I was watching the TV show as much as I was writing it.
Binge writing.
Yeah, binge writing, exactly. So there were times where I kind of would sit down to write and I'd say, oh no, this character has to go. I don't want them to go, but this is their time. So it was sad.
Sounds like you actually read a bit of a psychotic agent. The lesson here is it kind of the extraordinary cruelty and vulnerability of the other people. We enjoy watching that unfurl, don't we, as entertainment?
Yeah.
What's wrong with us?
Well, what's wrong with us? Yeah. I suppose there's kind of three components there in terms of, we all know that reality television is fun, but we also kind of like to point fingers and say, like, this isn't good societally. But the kind of question is, you know, do we blame the contestants, the producers,
yeah.
the viewers? And I think there's kind of a level of culpability there for everyone. But I think that it's interesting maybe being in the first person and that you can sort of experience Lily's every moment and kind of empathize with her experiences, but also know that you are a reader and a viewer and that you are sort of cheering on these horrible situations, and there is an element of kind of responsibility there, or I suppose like ethical watching, if that makes sense.
Do you, I mean, you're saying all three are culpable, the contestants, the producers and us, the audience. Who's mostly to blame though?
I don't know. I think that might be a question for the reader. I'll leave that up to you
guys. You watch a bit of Love Island, I presume. You must have.
Yeah, I definitely did. I haven't watched it in a couple of years, but I watched it a lot during lockdown.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. Yeah, it was. I thought it was a really fun time, and I also thought it was a great character study, I suppose, is maybe yeah. where this came from. But I think it definitely says a lot about society, ideas of desirability and the gamification of dating. And there's definitely a lot to unpack there, but it's also a fun time.
I think you've also described it as a brain pizza.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I'm going to use that more often.
Yeah,
it is that kind of. So do we feel guilty after? Did you feel guilty after watching Love Island?
Maybe sometimes, yes. I think that these people are put in very difficult situations for our entertainment. Maybe it is a question about what we're seeking, and that I think that reality television has kind of evolved in a really interesting way in the last couple of years, or the last while, and that, you know, George Orwell wrote of a nightmarish society where Big Brother is watching you, and we said, sounds great, let's watch it every night.
And then we put the camera in our pocket.
Yeah.
It was not even George Orwell, he had them mounted on the walls at
yeah,
least, and they could
exactly.
chat among the trees, but
yeah.
We bring the camera with us,
yes.
do the surveillance ourselves.
Yeah.
Did you feel sorry for the contestants? Because collectively it kind of shows sometimes that humans, as a collective, we can behave stupidly. But individually, you look at the people who've gone in there, very smart people. Maura Higgins, mm-hmm. who's come out and turned yeah. it into a whole industry for herself. Greg from Limerick, who's mm-hmm. a TV career. I mean, you couldn't call them stupid.
No, of course not.
So what is going on? Does Love Island reflect the badness that's already out going on anyway, and the pressure on how young people should look and how much fitness and things they have to inject into themselves?
Yeah.
Or do you, because you've thought about this a lot more than the rest of us, I think.
Yeah, I suppose this is what we're seeking. You know, this is a hugely popular television show, and it does seem sometimes that we want to humble beautiful people and sort of assume that they're stupid and then feel superior when we realise that they're not, you know.
Yeah.
And of course that these people are as fully realised, you know, as everyone watching it. And just because they're in sort of silly situations doesn't mean that, you know, their experiences are any less. But
they're edited as well.
They are edited. And I think that part of the element of reality television is that voyeuristic thrill where you can kind of sit back and say, well, I'd never do that. And that's very satisfying, I think. But I do feel sympathy for them. And I think that, I don't know, it does seem kind of nightmarish sometimes. And the lack of support maybe sometimes afterwards, kind of leaving this sort of almost fictional reality or fictionalized reality and then coming back. And I'm sure it all feels very surreal. So I am sympathetic. And I suppose I sort of gained more sympathy writing from Lily's point of view, particularly because I think that Lily, who presents herself as a dumb blonde, almost kind of invites the reader to judge her.
Yes,
does that make sense?
Yes, she does. And she's the main character. And there is a devastating passage in the book where Lily is kind of thinking back to her childhood and how she desperately wanted a thing, pestered her mother to buy it. And then when she gets the thing, she doesn't care about it anymore. This was a trampoline. Did you ever have this want?
Yeah, I'm afraid this was pretty similar. I wasn't quite as desperate as Lily, but yeah, she really craves a trampoline. And definitely I had the same experience where my sister and I decided we really, really wanted one. Everyone else has one. And we pooled all of our money together. And when I say money, it was mostly coppers. And we went to our mother and she was like, so this is 16 euro. This is not going to get a trampoline. And it was so devastating to me. It really, really was. It was so unattainable. But I think for Lily...
Lily got her trampoline.
She got her trampoline.
Did you get your trampoline?
We did, yeah.
Did the same thing happen where...
I think in the book, Lily kind of tires of it within weeks and she kind of thinks this is sort of for her the emblem of the sort of absence of meaning and material things and that she wanted it so badly. But it kind of felt that it was almost a job going on each evening to kind of appease her mother. And I definitely didn't find that when I was young. I had many happy tumbles on the trampoline. But I do think that there is a terrible sadness about outgrowing a childhood toy. And yes, I think the kind of the juxtaposition of like happily bouncing on a trampoline and then sort of looking at it with... not quite derision, but this kind of sense of, oh, I'm past that. It is,
I'm it's above
sad.
It now.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think we all kind of want to go back to those heady days of tumbling on a trampoline.
Happily, she doesn't learn her lesson. That's how she ends up in the compound.
Yeah.
Come here, when people hear the surname Rawl and the fact that you're from Leitrim, we put one and one, two together, whatever that phrase is. You're related to David Rawl.
Yeah, he's my brother.
Star of Moon Boy and also from Leitrim, of course. Your brother, David, who we've had in studio because he was off doing Peter Pan and I saw him in Youth the Season in the Abbey. He's doing great things.
Yeah, I'm delighted for him. He's having a great time and yeah, it's cool to see him like thrive and particularly on stage. We're both such fans of theatre, so it's great.
It's a household of artists growing up.
I guess so.
I didn't realise. Are there other siblings?
Yes, we have an older sister who's the best of the three of us.
Is she really? Yeah,
definitely.
Can I ask what she does or is she...
Yeah, she's a communications and branding specialist and she's excellent at what she does. But
that could be very handy.
Yeah.
for actors and novels in the family. Yeah. A communications and branding expert.
Yeah.
So she's looking at you going, oh, yes, okay. Correct this now. What are you going to do next? Because this is like such a sensational debut that people are talking about. The pressure is on to do another Jack Kerouac in 6 weeks and hammer out a novel.
Yeah, it's definitely not happening in 6 weeks, but I'm happily scribbling away at the next one. So.
Are you?
Yes.
And this lends itself to a drama series so well. Is there anything going on in that front or is it too soon?
The rights have been optioned, which is exciting. But,
already? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very early stages, so I don't, I'm not thinking about it. You know, I'm so happy that it's a book and it's coming out in the world and that's enough for me.
Are you kind of going to stay in this universe for the next novel?
No, I think moving away. But I really enjoyed sort of having, you know, the conversations around reality television and now sort of moving on to something else that's sort of maybe... kind of popular culture, see what other conversations there are.
More pop culture than Love Island.
Possibly.
I look forward to your novel about the lonely trampoline in Leitrim, rusting somewhere. The Compound by Aisling Rawl is out now at all the bookshops. It's out today, isn't it? Published by HarperCollins. Aisling Rawl, thanks a million.
Thank you very much.
And good luck.
Email oliver@rte.ie.